accession number 20456, reel 24.
Brigadier Wilson, reel 24. In June 1957, you were appointed a military assistant to Field Marshal Montgomery.
Correct.
On what basis do you think you were selected for that post?
A very strange basis indeed. There was a representative of the military secretary's branch at SHAPE. He was a Brigadier Dewar. He looked after the interests of British officers, SHAPE, the staff officers. And on one occasion, Monty sent for him and said, look, my present MA has posted to command an artillery regiment. I need a replacement. Get some names, if you please, from Whitehall. So a list of names appeared. I think there were about 7 or 8 of them. Produced by Duart Monty, who took a look at them and said, I don't know any of these people, what a useless lot, send them some more. My name was not on the first list, so a second list appeared in which my name was on. I don't know how it got on, it just did. And Monty made the same reply. He said, but this list is worse than the first. And said, but Field Marshal, you sort of slung the first 11 away. This is the second 11, of course, so worse than the first, really. And he said, but there's no one. I have no one here who I know. Is there anyone in SHAPE who knows any about these tolerably useless officers? Luckily, there were. There was a certain Colonel John Sloan, who was part of his strategic studies section, and the SHAPE Regimental Sergeant Major was Paddy Boyd, an Argyle. And Dewar said, well, at least you can talk to these people then, maybe this guy Wilson very well. So with bad grace, Monty knew them very well. He'd been Paddy Boyd's second DCM personally on him. Anyway, they were the marshal in. And as far as John Sloan was concerned, the interview told by John went very well. And unfortunately, Monty said, now, tell me, does he have any, what does he do when he's not serving any interest? And John stupidly said, oh, well, Phil Marshall, apart from games, he plays the bagpipes. And Monty said, good God, he said, a mad bagpiper. He might play in the office. I don't know how to do at all, you know. in haste, Paddy Boyd, the RSM, was marched in. And Paddy Boyd had been in my platoon in India, and I made him a full corporal. Monty looked at him and said, now, Mr. Boyd, a chap called Wilson in your regiment, do you know him? And Paddy Boyd said, yes, sir, very well, sir. He was my first commanding officer at Edinburgh in 1933. And so Monty said, no, I'm not talking about him, I'm talking about his son. Ah, he said, yes. He said, I know him very well, he's my platoon commander. And Monty looked at him and said, was he a good platoon commander? And Paddy Boyd, to his eternal credit, said, I thought so, sir. He gave me my second stripe. So Monty thought, that's it, you know, good judge of character. And he went round the staff saying, hey, well, if you want to find out about an officer, forget the military secretary, ask an RSM. Anyway, that was how I got the job.
You'd had no previous contact with Montgomery?
None whatsoever.
Had you any opinion of Montgomery or expectations
of him? No, I didn't. The only time I'd seen Monty was in 1945 at the lecture at the Staff College, just before he crossed the Rhine, and I was at Staff College. And when he took over as CIGS, he got us all into that theatre opposite the War Office where they used to do the farces. And he got
the Whitehall Theatre.
The Whitehall Theatre.
Subsequently owned by Paul Raymond, I think.
I didn't know that. Yes, so all the great
Brian Ricks used to perform there, yes.
Anyway, he got on the stage and he told us, the members of the War Office staff, what he thought of us, which wasn't very much. what was going to happen. Very interesting. Exactly like, you know, the addresses one I've seen on the newsreel where he stood in the tank and talked to the boys in the 8th Army.
Do you remember anything of what he said on that occasion?
Yes, sort of. I mean, basically, what he was saying was that the British Army had a very difficult job to do. It was contracting, the financial situation was such, but there were certain parts of the world that we couldn't just, you know, abandon just like that. And it was our job to look after them and see that all was well.
Did he deliver this in a convincing way? Did he win you over to his view?
Oh, yes. Proper stuff. I mean, the first time I really saw him at close quarters.
How much warning did you have that you were going off to join his staff?
The telephone rang in my office in the noon, one March day, from Edinburgh, and I was told that the Field Marshal wanted to see me, and I said, "What Field Marshal?" And they said, "Monty, you idiot." Well, the noon to the mill is somewhere. Anyway, I had a super sort of first class carriage ride down there. I really wasn't given no notice at all, and I went down and saw him, and he said, "Yes, you'll do me." And he then told me when I would report, which was in about a month's time, and that was it.
Do you remember anything else that he said on that first encounter? It was your first close encounter, wasn't it?
He asked me an awful lot about where I'd been, my family, what I thought of things. Very relaxed. Very interesting.
What sort of things was he asking you about, for your opinion?
Well, this was a somewhat worrying one. He was very interested in one's opinion of senior officers. And if you said, well, I don't know, say, come on, he said, you know, you've got an opinion, I want to hear it. I won't pass it on. If he asked you a question, he expected a direct answer.
Was it possible to ask him questions?
Yes.
Ask him to elaborate? Or
Yes. For example, in the dining room of the mill, there was a very nice picture of a bishop. And I hadn't gotten on, and I said, "Sir, the bishop, you know, who is he?" And he said, "Oh, he is my father. He was Bishop of Tasmania."
Would he tolerate argument? Would he tolerate the proposition of a view?
Well, at that time there wasn't any.
No.
Later on his staff, yes, there was. If he thought he was right, it was very difficult to get him to change his opinion. In fact, he did.
But even if he thought he was right, would he listen to alternative opposing and critical
certainly
views?
Certainly would.
He wouldn't just dismiss them, having made up his mind.
No.
So you had your telephone call, you had your interview with the Field Marshal. What happened next?
Well, I sort of got packed up and ready to move, as it were. I knew that there was a house for me at the mill. It was just a question of getting the family organised, getting the schools organised. Normal military move.
What was your appointment?
Were you military assistant.
Were you head of a substantial staff in that appointment?
No. The staff was odd. He was Deputy Supreme Commander under General Norstedt. In fact, Norstedt had an American three-star general chief of staff who most of the actual operational stuff went through. Monty's job was really what you might call training and looking to the future. And he also undoubtedly that this was never officially written by anywhere, acted as a sort of unofficial ambassador. And he would go and talk to people like the Pope and the Vicar General of the Jesuits and Tito, the sort of people that, the normal ambassador mightn't reach, as it were.
Were you then acting entirely on your own as a sort of direct assistant?
No, we had, he had a sort of chief of staff who he didn't want. He was a Major General Cochrane who was the gunner.
Yes.
They didn't get on. And what the Major Cochrane did, I never knew. But it was getting very embarrassing because, bits of paper were handed to me to deal with. With instructions of don't let General Cochrane see that, who know.
Do you know why it is they didn't get on?
Well, he never wanted Cochrane in the first place. Cochrane was the sort of chap that wouldn't have got on with Monty anyway. He was a nice enough chap, but he just wasn't that sort of person. He was a staff officer gunner, if you know what I mean. We had, for the staff, there was me, there was Claude Delacour, who was a commander in the French Navy, who had come to him from General de Lattre. There was his ADC, Sandy Chain, who basically his job was to look after the mill, his house here at Farnham. And after that, we had Mr. Davies, the chief clerk. We had his two personal secretaries. There was a team of three staff guards. It was quite small. And Cochrane had a chap called Jimmy Lynch, who was his Cochrane's own MA, as it were, but also acted as part of the team.
What sort of qualities did you need in order to be able to get on with Montgomery?
What sort of
qualities did you need to be able to get on with Montgomery?
That takes a little bit of thought. I think you needed, first of all, a fairly quick brain, because he didn't bother to repeat things twice. You needed a retentive brain, because he'd ask you, what was the policy about this, and he expected you to remember. You needed the ability to take decisions in his absence, because he trusted, once you were, established, you were trusted completely. And you needed a sense of humour, oddly enough. He could be very childish.
Can you think of some examples of him being childish?
Sort of funny little remarks and things. The story of the ambassador's car, when there was a big extras, and the embassy rang up me and said, we want a car for Louis Van Batten, who was then chief of defense staff. Unfortunately, we haven't got one as far. Would the field marshal lend us his number two Hummer? And I said, I'm sure he would, you see, but I thought I'd better just check. So I went in his office and I said, sir, the embassy ask if they could borrow your Hummer for doing my baton. Whereupon he said, certainly not. And I said, why? And he said, well, the embassy is a job to provide cars. They can come and have them. He said, I don't see why I should give him my car. And I said, but sir, I don't think we're going to use it. That doesn't matter. I might need to use it. I might want it. Where is it going to be? Driven around my buddy's old Louis. This is it's my toy. I'm not going to play with it. In the event it was, the embassy car broke down. That was a sort of, little bit of childishness.
Did he ever express a view of Lord Louis?
he liked him. I don't think he thought very highly of his strategic oversight. I think he was all for the changes that Lord Durham made in the defence staff.
Yes. Well, this was about the same time that Duncan Sands was contemplating major reductions.
Indeed.
And that involved amalgamations, didn't it?
Correct.
Staff level.
Correct.
And Montgomery was in favour of those changes.
Well, there was no reason why he couldn't be. I mean, finance alone would have...
Did he have any view of Templar that you recall?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's some wonderful influence. Frankie Festing, who appeared as CIGS, appeared in the office, dressed CIGS uniform, but with black rifle brigade buttons, rifle brigade lanyard, green and black lanyard that was fraying at the edges. If I remember rightly, brown shoes and yellow socks. And Monty took, and then he cracked Sam Brown, who was there, this huge guy. Monty took a look at him and said, "Frankie, you are the worst dressed soldier I've seen for years." And Frankie Festing said, "Well, Field Marshal, I haven't had some very good examples to follow."
And was there a rally to that return?
Oh, I mean, you know, but they were very great friends, you know. Mm. Yeah.
Well, what did he think of Templar as a strategist? Did he think
he had a very high opinion of Templar. Mm. Templar and he were very much of a muchness. Mm. They saw very strictly what had to be done and did it, and to hell with anyone who got in the life.
So, around about that time, there was a major dispute going on in the Chiefs of Staff between Mountbatten and Templar about all sorts of future issues in the Middle East and elsewhere. Did you hear anything about that at the time?
No, because you see, Monty was a NATO soldier and kept totally out of British affairs.
So you were insulated from that?
He deliberately kept out of them. Mm. The only time I know, when he told me this, it's not on record. I put it on record in my memoirs, oddly enough. We were talking about Suez. I came to him just after Suez had finished. Mm. He disagreed violently with Suez.
On what grounds?
Well, I'll tell you, Eaton sent for him to ask about his advice on Suez and describe what they were going to do. And apparently, Monty said to Eden, "Well, Prime Minister, that is very interesting. What is the aim of the operation?" And Eden said, "The aim is to knock NASA off its perch." And Monty said, "Excellent aim, but where are you going to? The perch is Cairo. You're not going there in the Cairo. What about the canal?" And Eden said, "Well, politically, a bit difficult to go to Cairo." So Monty said, "Well, all right, I accept that, but you have an aim, but you're not going anywhere near to achieving that aim." He said that we've only just come out of the place. If we go there, how much longer are we going to stay? How many men are we required to stay there? And Eden said, "Oh, well, that is business for the Treasury, you know." And he said, "It is. I'm a soldier. I would have to provide the soldiers to, you know, do this." And then apparently he said, "Prime Minister, you have forgotten, as the Chinese would say, the first rule of war." And Eden said, "What is that?" And Monty said, "If you start a war, make sure you win it." Now, that he was called for London for that. But as a NATO soldier, he took no part in the planning for Suez. Nothing.
Well, it would have been quite improper, wouldn't it?
Oh, it was quite wrong. Mind you, there were no French were involved up to an annexion, was it?
But not the Americans.
No. And I think rightly so. It's interesting to see, 10 years later, the aeroplanes have taken over anyway. The Suez Canal, as far as British strategic interests are concerned, had slightly gone down. But now, with carrier task forces and things, the canal's come back in its hand again.
And of course, they were always the commercial interests.
Of course. But I mean, how much commercial traffic now goes through the canal, I would not know.
Not as much as used to.
No. Nothing like.
Did you spend most of your time in Paris when you were on the staff?
Yes, entirely.
Where was the staff housed in Paris?
There wasn't one. Well, yes, there were temporary buildings. The shaped temporary buildings were Roquencourt, about 5 miles north of Versailles.
Yes.
In temporary accommodation. Yeah, it was quite nice. And there were bachelor officers' quarters there, but most of the married officers of all nations lived outside, in French leases.
What about you? Where were you?
I had a most lovely house at a place called Saint-Honoré, this was about 30 miles away from Chape, just over 40 minutes drive by car. In a little village near Merlon, not Merlin, not far from where the radio factory is at Flins, on the Seine. Beautiful place.
How big was the shape staff at that time?
Don't ask me. I'm sorry. It was pretty big. You see, you had all the nations there. And you had Turks, you had Greeks. They didn't go to get on with each other much. Germans, the Germans, of course, had come in.
Indeed.
Italians. We had a lovely Italian general, name of General Pispotti. He was a dear chap, actually.
What were you doing day to day? What were your routine duties as a military assistant?
Well, first of all, you had to sort the Orleans program out. He had a very, when he was in shape, he had a fixed program which he did not deviate by 1 minute. He had to be called at 8 o'clock in his bedroom by his personal stenographer, British, and his mail. And he would dictate the answers to his mail, the easy ones, there and then.
What, in bed,
in
or
bed.
Was he up?
Well, then he had both. And he would appear punctually at 10 in the office, by which time letters he dictated would be ready for his signature. And he'd probably have half an hour to deal with the other things. And then he would deal with day-to-day business. For example, he used to have one enormous exercise every year, which is strategic studies section, which was American, British, and French ran, and planning for that and all this bit. And usually in the morning there would be a distinguished visitor, some ambassador, some generals, dedicated for me, right at about 12. He had his own private dining room, which he would use for that, and they would discuss whatever it was to be discussed there.
Working lunch?
A working lunch. No less, just to, sometimes, no more. Very occasionally one was called into it with, if it was a complicated one, with the object of taking notes of what went on. Not to do without a pencil and paper to take notes with.
How are you supposed to take notes then? Just listen carefully and remember. It all had to go into
your
head.
You remembered.
Yes.
Something I haven't rather said. Anyway, and then at about 3:30 or 3, all the business they'd be done. He'd pack up, he'd go back to his hotel in Versailles, which the French provided for him, and he'd go for a walk in the park, go to bed quite early, all the rest of it. And that day ran like clockwork.
Was that 7 days a week or just in
the
working week?
No, because from time to time he maybe might be on a visit somewhere in France or Germany or somewhere else, or he would go home to England and relax in his mill.
You mentioned this grand exercise occurring once a year.
Yes.
What was the purpose of the exercise?
Studying the strategic implications of native towns. One lovely story. He did not get on with Marshal Lattassini. In this exercise, the North Great Room, there was an enormous great map of the NATO area, most of it, of course, covered by the Atlantic Ocean, where, you know, the whole business of resupply, when could stuff come in, how would it come in, how would they deal with the various submarine threats and so on. And there was Monty standing in the map, giving forth on, you know, with his pointer. And the Lapsus had a loud voice to say, "I don't know about this, there's only one chap I knew who ever would walk on water."
This was a map on the floor then?
Yes, huge, huge map on the floor.
It was a floor model?
Floor model, yes.
Was this in a purpose-built construction?
There was a purpose-built conference hall, yes, at Ashley, yeah.
Was this a sort of command post exercise, or...?
No. A command post exercise is what people... I don't know if my author's got it wrong, too. Command post exercise is when you actually get your staff officers and signals working, you know. No, this was your... certainly your staff officers, but your, you know, commanders discussing things.
Sounds like a committee game rather than a military
indeed,
exercise.
Indeed, yes. I mean, you know, it was a general sort of briefing with they stood up in the beard.
How long would it take, this big exercise?
I think it was 3 days, usually.
What level attended it as players?
Oh, the top level.
So all the senior commanders?
All your commanders, North Ag, Rhine Army, American Army, Europe, Air Forces, Navy... You know, Louis Mountbatten, you know. I mean, this was for the top, it was the top brass of NATO.
Would Sakura be there? Presumably,
yes,
he would watch that.
But he left it entirely for Monty to run. I mean, he would sum up at the end, yes.
Were there any diplomatic or political representatives?
You had the NATO ambassadors there, yes, certainly.
Who generated the scenario and the...
Well, this was done
script.
By the strategic studies section. Five officers, they're sort of up and coming, they all became generals. French, British, American. Sad.
What level were they? Were they...
Full colonels.
Full colonels. So there were five full colonels who were planning this exercise.
Under his direction. They used to meet once a week.
So Montgomery gave them the general direction.
Yes.
And they would then...
And they would come back the next week with what they'd done. Mm.
Did they have other functions besides generating the basis for the exercise?
Their functions entirely were savings.
Was there anyone playing the enemy during the course of the exercise?
Well, no, they produced that themselves.
So the five colonels... were the enemy.
Yes. I mean, we had no Russian, German, you know.